It's Monday, August 20, 2018. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The scandal over priestly child sexual abuse in the Roman Catholic Church in the state of Pennsylvania continues to expand. Tomorrow will mark just 1 week after the release of that historic report from a grand jury there in Pennsylvania, indicating after the course of an extensive investigation that at least 1,000 children, and it is believed thousands more, were abused by at least 300 priests over the course of about 70 years. And yet one of the most devastating parts of that report was the documentation of the complicity of several of the bishops of the church in covering for those priests, even in the face of indisputable evidence of the sexual abuse of children and teenagers. But even as the scandal continues to spread into ever more headlines, there is one major dimension of this story that has received scant attention. It's a theological dimension, a very important dimension that should be of interest, especially to evangelicals. It's a dimension that hasn't been much discussed at all, but it does come out if you see it in the headlines and then follow it in the story. For example, David Gambacorta, reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, released a major article in which he documents the case of the Reverend George Zerwas. He was identified as a friendly young priest who took a teenage boy to meet with three other priests, and then the priest together had the boy undress, and they then created their own child pornography. The boy, now an adult, gave testimony to the grand jury that is some of the most chilling you can find in the massive documentation. But the most interesting turn theologically is where we are told that even as all four of the priests were eventually relieved of their priestly responsibilities, it did not end their priesthood, according to the Sacrament of Orders of the Roman Catholic Church. Listen to how this comes out in the article. As Gambacorta reports, in 1987, the diocese in Pittsburgh was contacted by the family of a boy who claimed he'd been inappropriately touched by the priest, that is, George Zerwas. Then Bishop Anthony J. Bevilacqua refrained from taking action, but when another abuse complaint arrived a year later, Zerwas was sent for an evaluation. Still, he served at other parishes in the state until 1994, when he was placed on leave for what were described as personal reasons, as additional allegations swirled. Gambacorta then says, Zerwas was returned to active ministry by Bevilacqua's successor, Bishop Donald Wuerl, who is now the Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, D.C. But we are told Zerwas was benched again after yet another victim told the diocese that he had performed a sex act on him when he was 15. An attorney for the diocese in Pittsburgh said, quote, today we would have handled the Zerwas case much differently. Gambacorta then tells us that after being placed on leave for a second time, Zerwas was moved to Florida and then fled to Cuba. In the spring of 2001, in Havana, at a property he reportedly shared with another person, Gambacorta tells us, Zerwas was found strangled at age 47. Here's where the story gets most important. Quote, in a statement released Thursday, Cardinal Archbishop Wuerl lamented clergy abuse as a terrible tragedy and argued that he acted with diligence and concern for sex abuse victims when he was a bishop. But, said Gambacorta, he had struck a different tone in 2001 when he presided over Zerwas's funeral in Pennsylvania. According to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Wuerl described how Zerwas was a kind man and had preached a message of salvation through faith in Jesus. Quote, a priest is a priest. Once he is ordained, he's a priest forever, end quote. Now, if you catch what's being said here, you will notice that the major controversy concerning Cardinal Wuerl is whether or not he must resign as the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., and as a cardinal. There's a growing moral momentum that he must, and growing demands that he will. But as we are looking at this story, the most interesting line that leaps out at us from church history is the line that the archbishop, then a bishop, spoke at the funeral of this priest in 2001. As he said, a priest is a priest. Once he is ordained, he's a priest forever, end quote. Now, that is deeply rooted in Roman Catholic theology and canon law. It is reflected right now in the Catechism of the Roman Catholic Church. The Catholic Church defines the priesthood in just this way. It defines ordination as the sacrament of orders and explicitly states that once a man receives the sacrament of orders, he is a priest forever. At no point can he be anything other than a priest if his ordination was valid. This is very similar to the logic, by the way, of the Roman Catholic Church, which doesn't recognize divorce but does recognize annulments because it says a marriage cannot be dissolved ever unless it was illegitimate in the beginning, which means it never existed and thus it is merely annulled. And what you're looking at here, and this is what's so haunting, in words that were spoken at the funeral of a priest who had been strangled after all these documented cases of child sex abuse, it was at that funeral that the man who is now the Cardinal Archbishop of the Catholic Church in Washington, D.C., repeated the words, "A priest is a priest. Once he is ordained, he's a priest forever." Notice what then-Bishop Wuerl was saying. He was saying that this man, after all the documented abuse of children and after all clerical responsibility had been removed from him, was still a priest. And once you understand that aspect of Catholic teaching, you also have to go further and understand there are two big issues behind that statement. One is the Catholic understanding of the priesthood, and the other is the Catholic understanding of the sacraments. The Catholic understanding of the priesthood is that the priesthood emerges out of the bishop, out of the ministry of the bishop, in continuity and in succession, going all the way back, they claim, to Peter, going all the way back to Matthew chapter 16. But they then argue for the priesthood as being defined in the Old Testament in continuity with the New Testament, with Jesus Christ, as he's described in Hebrews, as a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek, being the example for human priests. Furthermore, it is claimed that these priests have a sacrificial ministry in which, by the administration of the Mass and the administration of the entire sacramental system, the priests actually have authority from Christ himself in the name of the Roman Catholic Church to forgive sins, effectively to hold heaven and hell, that is, eternal judgment, in their own hands and at their own dispensation. But here's where we also must understand the literal nature of the Catholic belief in the sacraments. And of course, they claim seven sacraments. And what do we mean by that? We mean that the Roman Catholic Church officially teaches that once a man is ordained, there is a fundamental change that cannot ever be reversed. That is a change from one state into another, from the lay state into the clerical state, being transformed from a mere baptized Christian into a priest according to the order of Christ. But in order to understand all this, we have to go back to the 16th century and to the Reformation. We have to go back to Martin Luther and John Calvin and understand that when the Reformation took place in the 16th century, one of the reasons the Reformation took the shape that it did was in answer to the entire Roman Catholic understanding of the priesthood and the Roman Catholic theology of the sacraments, and in particular, the sacrament of orders or the Roman Catholic teaching concerning ordination. At the most basic level, both Luther and Calvin, and beyond them, the radical reformers went even further, arguing that the priesthood is not given to a class or a hierarchy within the church, and furthermore, there is no continuation of a priesthood beyond Christ other than the eternal truth that Jesus Christ, as prophet, priest, and king, is our eternal high priest. The Reformers insisted upon the fact that Christ, in his sacrificial ministry on the cross, was the last sacrifice, thus we do not believe in the Mass as a repeated sacrifice, and that Christ is the only priest we ever need. Now, the Reformers went beyond that because of the teaching of the New Testament and said that in one sense, not in a sacrificial sense, but in a communal, congregational sense, every single Christian is a priest. The priesthood is the congregation now, in the sense that we minister to each other and for each other. But it is not an atoning sacrificial priesthood. It is not a mediatorial priesthood. It is merely a priesthood of encouragement in the Word, and it is a priesthood that is rooted in the congregation, in the church, fulfilling its ministry, including church discipline and everything empowered to the church. There is no hierarchy, thus, within the church as understood in the Reformation, and there is certainly no priestly class. There is no priestly ordination. There is no fundamental change in an individual who is lay at one point and then a minister at another point. In the midst of the battle for the Reformation, Luther said this, quote, of this sacrament, meaning the sacrament of ordination, the Church of Christ knows nothing. It is an invention of the Church of the Pope. Not only is there nowhere any promise of grace attached to it, but there is not a single word said about it in the whole New Testament, end quote. Luther went on to say that the Roman Catholic sacrament of ordination or orders, quote, makes no one a priest or minister in the eye of God, end quote. The Reformers and Reformation-based churches going all the way down to the present understand that there are those within the church called to a particular teaching ministry. There is a teaching office, but it is not a priestly office. And furthermore, it is not an office conferred by a bishop with some claim of continuity all the way back to Peter, claimed to be the first pope. Rather, it is a responsibility, a gift, and a calling that is biblically defined and biblically qualified that is conferred on the basis of the congregation's authority, insofar and for as so long as the congregation deems it fitting and right for an individual to continue in that teaching office. On another occasion, Luther expressed the issue this way, quote, this is the way to distinguish between the office of preaching or the ministry and the general priesthood of all baptized Christians. The preaching office, said Luther, is no more than a public service, which happens to be conferred. Luther put an emphasis on the word conferred upon someone by the entire congregation, all the members of which are priests. But after we have become Christians through faith, then each one, he means every Christian, according to his calling and position, obtains the right and the power of teaching and confessing before others this word which we have obtained from him, meaning Christ. In agreement, John Calvin in Geneva argued that there is no priesthood beyond the priesthood that comes to every believing Christian by virtue of being a Christian, and that is a non-sacrificial, non-atoning priesthood. There is no claim of any human being a mediator. It is Jesus Christ who is our sole and sufficient mediator. Furthermore, both Luther and Calvin, along with the other reformers, agreed that it is preaching that stands at the center of the ministry that Christ gave to his church, and the teaching office is essentially a preaching office. It is not a mediatorial office. It is not a sacramental office. In the Catholic sense, it is certainly not a priestly office. Now compare that to the Catechism of the Roman Catholic Church, which states at paragraph 1583, quote, it is true that someone validly ordained can, for a just reason, be discharged from the obligations and functions linked to ordination, or can be forbidden to exercise them, but he cannot become a layman again in the strict sense, because, and again I'm reading directly from the current catechism, quote, the character imprinted by ordination is forever. The vocation and mission received on the day of his ordination mark him permanently, end quote. Furthermore, Canon 290 of the current canon law of the Roman Catholic Church states, quote, once validly received, sacred ordination never becomes invalid, end quote. Those cited sections of the Catechism and the canon law of the Roman Catholic Church, consistent with centuries of claims by Roman Catholicism, explain how at the funeral of a man who was documented to have been a serial child sexual abuser, how the current Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, D.C., Donald Wuerl, then a bishop, could say again at the man's funeral, quote, a priest is a priest. Once he is ordained, he's a priest forever, end quote. There are no doubt many contributing factors to this exploding scandal in the Roman Catholic Church, a scandal that will continue to expand by every estimation, and it will not be limited to the six dioceses in Pennsylvania covered by this grand jury report, nor, for that matter, will it be limited to Pennsylvania. We already have the situation where the scandal has reached the Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, D.C. But our attention in this case is drawn to the statements made by that bishop, now Cardinal Archbishop, years ago at the funeral of a man he still recognized as a priest. All of this reminds us, sadly enough, that when theology has consequences, sometimes those consequences can be horrifying indeed. But next, as we're talking about the fact that theology matters and it always matters, we turn not to the Roman Catholic Church, but rather to the Mormons. But as we shall see, we're not supposed to use that word anymore. More importantly, Mormons aren't supposed to call themselves Mormons anymore. There's a backstory, and in the pages of the New York Times yesterday, Julia Jacobs reports, quote, the word Mormon is out, says the president of the Utah-based church, but the proper term for what to call the faith and its followers is a mouthful. In an announcement, she says, on Thursday, President Russell M. Nelson insisted that Mormons and non-Mormons alike stick to the term The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Mr. Nelson, age 93, said that the policy change came to him in a revelation from God and that members of the church must work to adjust their vernacular. As President Nelson said, quote, "The Lord has impressed upon my mind the importance of the name He has revealed for His church." Jacob summarizes the issue well when she tells us the church's updated style guide specifies that Mormon church, Mormons, and Mormonism are no longer acceptable. And no, she says, you should not use the abbreviation LDS either. The only exceptions, according to the new style guide, include the Book of Mormon, which, after all, explains why people call the Mormons Mormon. And there are certain other uses of the word Mormon that will continue, such as in references to the Mormon Trail, but that's partly because that historic route is commemorated by the government, not just by the Latter-day Saints or by Mormons, and we're not supposed to say either of those any longer. As Jacob says, quote, "The abrupt shift was left largely unexplained by the church, whose spokesman declined to elaborate on the rationale behind the new policy, but church leaders have promoted the idea for decades," end quote. Indeed, this has been an issue of ongoing conversation. The Mormons did not want to be called the Mormons, even though they refer to the book they claim is the successor to the Bible as the Book of Mormon, that book being absolutely central to their ideological and theological identity. But the Mormons became known as Mormons largely because of the Book of Mormon, and over time, the Mormons accepted being called Mormons, so much so that until this past week, if you asked Mormons if there was any offense in calling Mormons or the Mormon Church Mormon or Mormonism and referring to the religion, you were told no. But all that changed, and here's where the theology matters so much. First of all, on whose authority was this change announced? The authority of the president of the church. Here's what's so theologically crucial. Mormon theology is based upon the understanding that at the top of the hierarchy of the church is a president who is understood to be a living prophet who continues to receive authoritative prophecy from God. That is why President Nelson expressed this new teaching this way, quote, "The Lord has impressed upon my mind the importance of the name He has revealed for His church," end quote. Notice all the claims to revelation there. Patrick Mason, who's the head of Mormon studies at Claremont Graduate University, said quite correctly, quote, "The wording of this statement is stronger than anything we've seen in the past. This came not from his own intuition or his own sense of things. Rather, we should say it is claimed, from inspiration from heaven. That's about as strong language as he can use," end quote. Indeed, the Mormon president is claiming that God himself has ordered that Mormons shall not refer to their movement as Mormonism, nor to their church as Mormon, nor to themselves as Mormons. Rather, they are to use the name that it is claimed was revealed by God to Joseph Smith back in the founding era, and that is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But here we should also note that quite conveniently, Joseph Smith claimed to receive this revelation when there were questions about what the church that he was establishing should be called. In the book known as the Doctrine and Covenants, which is a part of the overall structure of the scripture claimed by Mormonism, in section 115, at number 3, I read, quote, "And also unto my faithful servants who are of the high council of my church in Zion, for thus it shall be called, and unto all the elders and people of my church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints scattered abroad in all the world, for thus shall my church be called in the last days, even the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints," end quote. As Allison Chu, reporting for the Washington Post, summarizes, quote, "With 8 words, 11 syllables, and 1 hyphen, the full name of the Mormon Church is quite the mouthful," again referring to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. 8 words, 11 syllables, 1 hyphen. There is an acknowledgement, even amongst many insiders, that this isn't going to work, that there will not be a cessation of references to Mormonism and to Mormons. Rather, when you look at how deeply embedded it is, you also see that even Brigham Young University, that is the central educational institution of the church, has professors who teach Mormon studies. The church made the official announcement on Twitter under the official name Mormon Newsroom, in which they tweeted, "President Russell of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has made the following statement regarding the name of the church." As someone responded immediately, quote, "No more using the word Mormons," reports Mormon Newsroom. Now, just as an historical fact, many religious groups are not known by the name they might choose for themselves. For example, I'm a Baptist. Baptists did not at first name themselves Baptists. Rather, they were referred to by others as Baptists, usually as a matter of argument, by the way, because of the centrality of believers' baptism by immersion to the Baptists. But the name Baptist stuck, and by the time the First Baptist Association is formed, it pretty much names itself as Baptists, and rather consistently so thereafter. Methodists did not intend to name themselves Methodists, but they were called Methodists because of their methodical system of devotion going back to John Wesley. You can pretty much figure out how Lutherans got their name. Presbyterians gained their name as reference to their Presbyterian form of church government, the unit being a presbytery. And then, of course, Episcopalians in the United States were known as Anglicans in the Church of England until the Revolution made that rather untenable. And they named themselves Episcopal in order to define themselves according to the Episcopos or the bishop, according to their own church government. But the bottom line in just the actual way language works is that once a group is known by some kind of name, such as the Mormons have been known now for so long, and since their central text that they claim as authority is known as the Book of Mormon, it's very unlikely that Mormons will be known as anything other than Mormons, regardless of what the Mormon president says, even when he says don't use the word Mormon. Mormon, by the way, refers to a central character in Mormon history. It is claimed that in the 4th century after Christ, he lived in the United States as a member of the tribe known as Nephites, and he was given the responsibility to be the primary compiler through whom revelation was made of what became known as the Book of Mormon, a project that was continued by his son known as Moroni. But even as the big issue in the media is about the name, the bigger issue is about the claim to revelation made by the Mormon president. That's what's really of theological significance. And, of course, the larger issue behind why the Mormon president would indicate this insistence upon that long name. 8 words, 11 syllables, and 1 hyphen. Why would it be so important to the Mormons to be known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? Well, this is the biggest of all theological issues. It is because the official teaching of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, popularly known as the Mormons, is that their church is the restoration of the true church, which had disappeared on earth between the time of the disciples, properly the apostles, all the way until Joseph Smith in the United States in the 19th century. The central claim of Mormonism, amongst many claims of Mormonism, is that the Church of Jesus Christ had disappeared until the Lord restored the priesthood and the church in what became known, not by accident, as it was claimed, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Notice the definite article, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In that name, there is a clear claim to identity with Jesus Christ, but a clear claim of discontinuity and absolute distance from the church from the time of the apostles until Joseph Smith. That explains why the Mormon Church denies such central and essential Christian doctrines as the doctrine of the Trinity, or for that matter, the doctrine of justification by faith, salvation by grace alone. Put in that context, you understand that the Mormons are saying that all other churches, all other Christian churches, are not real churches, but rather are representations of churches that have lost the gospel and have lost their tie to Christ. Rather, they say, the priesthood, as they define it, was absent during all those centuries until it was reestablished, restored in the ministry of Joseph Smith and those who established the church in the 19th century. And that explains why a name is a name, but a name is always more than a name, and why there is far more than the question of nomenclature when the president of the Mormon Church says that Mormons shall no longer be known as Mormons, but rather externally and internally they should be referred to as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. That's not just a name, it's a claim. It's a truth claim, and evangelical Christians had better understand it clearly. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.